Shaw, Reel 7. I think we'll actually hold that story till we come up to it in the thing. So what were you actually doing? You were going on these convoys that weren't properly organised. And
oh, no, we weren't going on the convoys to start with. They weren't. We were just going out mainly searching for U-boats. And we'd stay out for a week or 8 days or thereabouts, and they'd go back to Liverpool, you see.
So it's anti-submarine sweeps?
Yeah. Really.
And did you have any way of discovering? I mean, did you have ASDIC or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. ASDICs.
And what do you remember of these anti-submarine sweeps? You might want to tell the story about that. What on one of them, this gunnery officer did something. If you want to tell.
Yeah, well, we were out with the Highlander, two of us. They used to, that was it. They'd send two of you out at a time, normally. And the Highlander had the senior officer, he was in charge, had a commander on there, and ours was a lieutenant commander. So the after a while, I forget exactly what day it was or how long we'd been out, they sighted this U-boat on the surface. And the U-boat didn't spot ours, apparently. And anyway, we both charged after it, you know, way up, full speed, and eventually we sank it between the two. We had depth charges.
You'd be down below, so you wouldn't see much of it, would you?
No, I didn't see a lot of it. But this is what. So. But I was up on deck when we started to pick up the German survivors, or some of them. You could see their red lights glowing in the. They had red. And I never. Do you know what? I never felt angry towards them. I felt sorry. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. That's just a personal. Now, the messman I was telling you about used to look after our mess. His wife lived in London, and London had been getting a hell of a lot of air raids, as you know. And he went berserk, and he raced up onto the machine gun, one of the machine guns, and I don't know whether he knew how to use it or not, but he was going to fire at the German survivors, and that was when the gunnery officer had to leap up and pull him off it. You know, told him, I don't know what he said to him, but I would happen to be up on deck at the time when this happened. I'd been on watch and then came off watch. I think it must have been the dog watch. I'd had from 4 to 6, I think, and I was So that's the occasion I remember the gunnery officer, but apart from that, we didn't see much of them, really.
Now, what would a typical watch be like on that ship, then? If you could just go through it. And I know some of it will be a bit similar to the thing. So you went on watch, a four-hour watch. What would you be doing?
First of all, you'd acknowledge any orders from the bridge. Increase speed, decrease speed.
Would you be in charge of the engine room?
Oh, yes.
And what were you by this time?
To start off with, when I first went on board, I didn't have my engine room watchkeeping certificate. And so what happened there was that they reorganised the watches so that the two ERAs who had theirs did the night watches, and the chief ERA would come down with me, and we would do the, let me think this, I think it was the, anyway, to it, we'd do the first from 8 o'clock till midnight, and the afternoon from 12 o'clock till 4. And he would be around then. He wouldn't necessarily stay there in the engine room, but he would be around so that if I got into any, or not just me, but anybody else in that situation, got into any difficulties, they could get hold of him quickly because he wasn't asleep. You with me? But very often he'd stay down for ages until he thought you got the hang of it properly, and gradually, and this is how it would go, and then eventually, while I was on there, I got my engine room certificate. So I was able to go down on my own, and he was able to carry on, and everybody else was in their proper watches. You with me? Three watches, you see? So that's how it started.
And what would you actually do then? You
were right, so let's get to the point where we say the ERA is in charge of the watch. So he would then, as I say, obey any orders from the bridge, increase or decrease speed, And then every so often he would go in and check the oil levels in all the pumps that were running, etc., etc., and make sure the temperatures of all different things were correct and so forth and so on. And you just do that gradually. And then in the end, after the 4 hours, your relief would come down and you'd tell him if there was anything special going on and how many boilers were connected, one or two or something. And then you'd sign the register and you'd go off watch and then your relief would take over.
Now, that doesn't sound like too much hard work. I mean, was there more to it than that, or was it the responsibility?
Oh, no, it wasn't hard work. During the watchkeeping wasn't hard work. It was just a question of trying to keep awake in all this business, you see, and the responsibility. That was it. The only time there was any hard work was if anything broke down, and then you usually had a standby. If one of the pumps broke down, you always had a standby, but then you wanted to get the other one repaired, and so you could be involved then in repairing the other pump with the help of somebody else who had come along, you know what I mean?
So how would you repair a pump?
Well, it would depend what sort of repair was needed. You see, it might be that a piston was broken or something, so you'd have to get a spare piston. We had stores, engineer stores, you see, get a spare piston, etc., 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 and replace it. And sometimes it would take several hours, and sometimes it would only take, well, half an hour or something to repair it. It depended what the job was.
How reliable were the engines, and how often would you have to do repair work?
They were pretty good actually. Didn't really have a lot to do in that. In as far as that was concerned, we every now and again. I'm just trying to think how many days. I ought to know this off by heart, but I don't know. It was all laid down in the Admiralty Fleet Orders that the boilers would have to be cleaned and the tubes checked. And this was after how many days was it?
When you were in port, I presume.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And how would you clean the boilers then?
Well, you first of all, you have to empty the boiler, you see.
How would you do that?
Well, you'd open they have on either side of the two water drums at the bottom, they'd have what they call running down valves, you see, which would lead out to the sea, you see, and then you'd gradually you'd empty the boiler that way, you see. And then when the boiler was empty and it was safe enough to get in other words, it wasn't still too hot. This is when you'd get in to examine the boiler, and it was usually the stokers would usually be involved in the cleaning, and they'd have brushes that they would push down the tubes, you see. But I mean, nowadays, I mean, it's all modernised now, and I mean, I don't know why.
Right, then we're interested.
and that was it. And then you'd check the joints on the boiler doors and renew those, and any other jobs that needed doing, any of the accessories, and eventually be checked, usually by the chief ERA or a senior boiler maker. I would check the boilers, or if it was something really serious. And of course, finally, it would be the engineer officer, it was his responsibility to make sure everything was
there any other routine big maintenance jobs you had to do? I mean, anything with the engine as opposed to the boiler?
Well, let me think now. They'd be... I'm just trying to think of the periods. It was all these things were sort of laid down in the Admiralty Fleet Orders and the engineering manuals. And all the times, if possible, I mean, very often during the war, it couldn't be done. But you had to, as near as possible, stick to those routines and stick to the times.
So that was. But what would you do with the engines? What routine tasks would you have with them?
Well, you'd probably have to have a look at the
turbines.
Take the the condenser doors off to make sure there were no leaks there in the tubes, everything running smoothly. They had door access doors to look at the where you could sort of look at the turbine to see whether all the blades were, you know, none of the blades had been knocked off or rotted away, or rotted in the exact corroded that sort of thing. You know, you could get inside inside the turbine casing. But usually, lots of these things could be spotted. Not exactly spotted. You could hear something going wrong during the course of running, and you say, "No, what? There's something odd about this. Next time we get the chance, that sort of thing would arise." You see, or of course, nasty if you got damaged, if you got hit with something, or really got damaged. Well. That's another story, but I'm talking about the normal procedure now.
Now, when you weren't an engine room watch, what other duties would you have, or would you just be off duty?
Well, you would be, once you came off watch, you were off duty, but during the war, and actually you were at action stations, and as soon as the action of the alarm went, you'd go to your action station.
And what was your action station?
Well, mine was usually the boiler room. In fact, I can't think of any ship. Yeah, it was usually the boiler room.
And what would you be doing there? I mean, because you'd have the normal squad team there. What would the action station be?
Well, you'd be there in case, in an emergency, you had to sort of suddenly shut off several valves or open several valves, you know what I mean? Do something in an or start, for instance, on the in the forward, one of the boiler rooms on the harvester, they had a diesel dynamo. Right, and then supposedly there was a failure with the lights, there'd be a turbo generator as well, that went, then person's action station, they would be, his job would be to start the diesel dynamo up as quickly as possible to get the power back, you know, sort of things like that. I'm just trying to trying to think of a few more.
So I think the next thing is what happened after that, the initial. You had these anti-submarine sweeps, yeah, a couple of them, with the Highlander and with, you know. What's the next thing you recall?
Well, so eventually the convoy system was really organised, and we were shifted to Gorak. Gorak was our base then. This was in, must have been 1941. I don't know exactly what month in 1941, but it was in 1941, Gorak. And what would happen then would be that... in the meantime, I think that Mark Thornton had left the ship, and the person who relieved him was a commander by the name of Tait. Remember I mentioned his name yesterday, actually, T-A-I-T, whose father apparently was a padre or a minister.
Do you remember his first name?
No, I can't remember his first name.
And what was Tait like?
One of these very tall, aloof people who didn't really speak to... He must have spoken to somebody in a wardroom, I suppose, but that's the impression you got of him. But it appeared as... as though he knew his job anyway. So he then became the senior officer of our escort group. He was a commander. And then we'd have...
Do you know which escort group it was?
The number? No. No, but it's in... I've got a book in there, and I think it's in there somewhere.
That we'll look it up later, yeah.
The escort would consist of flower class... the flower class corvettes. It's the Cruel Sea... Flower class corvettes. Anyway,
so were you on North Atlantic convoys?
Most.
So, what would a typical North Atlantic convoy be like for you? Where would you meet? I mean, going from this end, where would you meet?
Well, we would leave Gorak and we just get out the entrance to the Clyde for, you know, just out, and then we'd meet nearly all the merchant ships, and there's dozens of them usually, and there'd be two or three destroyers and several flower class corvettes, and they would be the escort, and the senior officer would be responsible for issuing the orders and making sure where they all were, etc., etc. And then away you'd go, and then it would depend. Sometimes it was a slow convoy, in other words, you're only going to do 6 or 7 knots, and that would take ages to get to the other side. Most of our convoys went into St. John's, Newfoundland, and then from there back again to Gore.
So what was it like going at that speed? I mean,
well, it seemed as though it was going on forever, and we were always glad when we got in. And of course, you never.
What about that? We're rushing on a bit. What about the zigzagging?
We had to do all that. That was.
Was it ordered or was it programmed? I mean, would they say?
No. What do you mean? Whether it was.
Well, how was it ordered?
Well, I think, I don't know, I think that each convoy, there was a commodore usually on the boat, and I think he was the one responsible for doing the zigging and zagging. But I'm not 100% sure about this, mind you. But anyway, I think that was it, and he would issue the order. But whether it was, I don't think it was preordained. I think he did it and say, right, everybody, why you were, but I don't know. I don't really know about that.
And what was routine life like on the convoy? What was?
Well, you just, it was a bit dull and deadly, but you got the odd every now and again action stations. Usually U-boats, action stations, and everybody dashed down to their action stations and all the rest of it. And then if you got a what they called a ping, the ASDEC's picked up, then the depth charges would be dropping depth charges, etc., etc., etc. And that was it. But we always hoped of course, it never happened.
And did you get many casualties? I mean, many ships hit in the convoy.
Oh yeah, especially with the last one when we were finally sunk.
But before that.
Oh yeah, we got the merchant ships would be sunk. And then you'd either have one of the frigates chasing around trying to sort out the U-boat, or, you know, it depends. That's when the captain in charge, the chap in charge of the escorts would issue the order for this one to do that and that one to do that, and you go out there and this sort of thing.
Did your ship claim any more kills of U-boats during that period?
Only the one where, at the finish, where we were actually.
So the same time as you. Yeah. But before that, so it was just the one on the sweeps. But
no,
then
I can't remember. I can't remember anymore. No, I can't remember any more being claimed. There's some sort of chasing around and some near misses, and you didn't know for sure whether you'd got it or not. But I don't definitely.
And what was the weather like?
Oh, well, on one occasion, this is when we weren't doing a convoy, this is before the convoy's system. One of the engines, I think, was doing about 10 knots. The other one was practically stopped, and we weren't moving because of the seas were so, the amount of seas coming over the top, and one of our boats was washed overboard, and one of the other destroyers that was with us, I forget which one it was, had actually one of the gun turrets washed overboard. Mountainous sea, 70 feet wave. 70, you wouldn't believe it. I went on watch. What time did I go on watch? Anyway, I was on watch for 13 hours. I wasn't the only one. You couldn't get up, because to go on watch, it wasn't enclosed. You went out onto the open deck, and they had handrail to hang on to. And of course, the ship's going over and up like this, and you had to sort of really run for it. But it was so bad on this occasion that two of us, in fact, I think it might have been the whole three of us, there were three in three watches. You could only go in daylight. You'd take a chance in daylight. And I was on what? I think it was the... what watch was it I was supposed to have had?
Doesn't make a lot of difference.
That means I was on watch for 13 hours instead of four, because none of the others could get down.
It would be like that on the convoys as well, bad weather.
Well, I don't think we ever got one quite as bad as that. Was about the worst. But oh yes, you get horrible, and very often when you got near to Newfoundland, you run into fog. We would be taking a course up, you know, just south of Greenland, you know, and you get fog and. Up on the bridge, it must be they didn't know where they were. And of course, in early on, they didn't have the radar wasn't so sophisticated or anything like that. You see what I mean? It was all half of it was guesswork. But we managed to get through, struggle through.
What about cold?
Oh yeah, it used to get very cold and damp and all that sort of thing. But I suppose.
What would you wear?
Let me see now. Normally, on watch, most of us would just have a pair of underpants on and an overall suit. And boots, of course, big boots, because the plates would be quite hot. And socks. And a cap, you'd have a cap, and that was about it. Or gloves, usually had gloves.
And when it was cold?
When it was cold, of course, you'd have the old roll neck pullovers and put your jacket on, so there's jackets and a coat. And of course, up on the bridge, they had duffel coats and all this business, you see, all covered in duffel coats. So, yes, it wasn't all that wonderful. But there you are. You get to...
What about the food on the destroyer as compared to the battleship? I mean... What were the food arrangements?
We on the destroyer and quite a lot of small ships, you had the option of you either had canteen messing, what they called, or general messing. Now, general messing was similar to what you'd have on a battleship. But canteen messing was you could choose your own. But you'd have to pay for it. You'd have a mess bill. It wasn't much, but you'd pay. And the ERAs, because we were the highest paid, we were one of the few sort of on the lower deck who could afford to do that. So we used to have a cooked breakfast. No, we would have bacon and egg, or we might have fish, or usually it'd be something like bacon and egg. Or mind you, we had all sorts of comical names for it at the time. But... or sausage and egg, and so we'd have a good breakfast and dinner time. And
what would you eat at dinner time?
Well, it'd be something similar, except that you would probably have in dinner time you wouldn't have chosen it. It would be similar for everybody, but it would be quite reasonably appetizing. You know, soup again would be the main thing, and. And then you'd get maybe a bit of meat or chicken or whatever. And of course, although the civilians were heavily rationed, the forces got more than the civilians, but we still had dried egg. It wouldn't be a fresh egg. Not unless we got over to the other side, where you were somewhere near America, and we were still rationed for sugar, but not to the same extent that they were, the civilian population were.
What would you get to drink? Would it be tea, or would it be kai? Cocoa, I think.
Oh, kai, yeah, the old kai. How did you pick that one up?
Kai? Well, what do you remember of kai?
It's a nickname, kai. Well, the kai... when I first started, it was really great big thick pieces of coarse chocolate sort of whipped. And you'd have to break, and we used to love it during the middle watch, help to keep you awake. And very often, you could practically, you'd almost have to use a knife and fork instead of, it was so thick, but we liked that, kai. Yeah, that was the nickname for it, kai. Very good, that, yeah. And we all used to like that. And they used to very often boil up, they'd have a great big urn, because there'd be several people, especially on a battleship on watch, and one of the stokers usually would go down below and open one of the steam drains, and the steam would be boiling up the, you know, until it was hot, and then it all passed, and of course the chief of the watch would get the first mug, you see, and then so forth and so on. And very often they'd bring soup down, you know. Some people would bring soup that they saved over from lunchtime or something or other, and have soup as well. Depends, you know.
Would you drink tea as well?
Tea, yeah. But the tea was never all that good, but there was nothing else anyway. Wouldn't drink tea during the middle. Morning watch, you know, from 4 to 8, you'd probably have tea. That's right. During the middle, it would be kai, cocoa. And during the first, and what was it during the first? Can't remember now, but it could have been either or both.
Was the tea very highly sweetened as well? Or, I mean, was it a thing that you might think of as naval tea, you know?
Yeah, but you got used to it. It was... I wouldn't like to try it now, tea, but you got used to the tea. It didn't seem to do anybody any harm, as far as I
know. Was there a lot of sugar in it?
No, I don't think so. I think you could, not that I can remember, I think if you put your own sugar... I used to take sugar then, I don't take it now, but I think you just put your own sugar in and that was it, if you wanted it.
And anything else about the typical convoy out? Before we get there,
before they had it really organised, there was always this danger area between, for about a third of the way out, you were covered, and then you could get air cover, but there was always a gap for a long time. Of about a third in the middle where you didn't have any air cover, and that's when they introduced these homemade aircraft carriers and so forth, you know what I mean? And also eventually when the Americans came in, and then they used to be able to fly planes from Iceland down, but so eventually the whole of the Atlantic route was covered by air as well as. But at one time, for quite a long time, it wasn't. You know, there was always a dangerous bit in the middle. And you used to get, all of a sudden, get the air raid alarm would go. And it would usually be just one lone bomber or something. And we didn't have any trouble with them, actually. But some of the other convoys did. It was just all potluck, isn't it, really?